From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's State of the Union speech, given on Thursday, was the talk of the town in Washington Friday. But we decided to take it back to Moscow to discuss this with our analyst, Mark Sloboda, who's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University. Well, Mark, a rather interesting speech by President Putin yesterday, and of course is being completely mischaracterized here and presented ahistorically, as is the norm for the American media. So why don't you tell us what it looked like to you sitting in Moscow watching it yesterday?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Don. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
I think this was a monumental speech in multiple ways. I think this is actually two different speeches, right? There is a more typical, we should say, State of the Union speech. Although, unlike a typical State of the Union speech, instead of kind of rhetorical self-aggrandizement, as is, you know, reassuring everyone how great the United States is and everything, Putin very directly, very specifically, with a ton of facts, you know, PowerPoint presentations coming up behind him, more sophisticated than PowerPoint, but right. Visual presentations,
right.
Putting up the graphs, all the numbers, everything he was talking about, highlighting, you know, what they have done, what the situation is now, you know, after the economic sanctions and where everything has been over the last few years, how the government has recovered, what the problems still are, and then he projected a very detailed plan for the future, which he specifically said this is, he believes, what any Russian president, whoever is elected next month, really needs to follow through on, mm-hmm. right? And this is a very detailed plan of the future. It's ambitious. He laid out exactly why he thinks it's possible. It must be said, Putin will be reelected next month. Mm-hmm. The most recent pre-election polling shows him at 69.5% of people that are likely voters who will choose to vote for Putin for reelection.
Right.
No other candidate is, you know, much above 10%, if that. Maybe for the communist candidate, the communist businessman Grudinin, who is famous for his strawberry Holko's farms,
right,
outside it. Moscow.
Right.
He wouldn't be my candidate for the Communist Party,
right.
but we'll leave that for the election.
That's right.
We'll discuss that in greater detail. But even the liberal pro-Western fringe opposition in Russia, right? The shall we say, the eternal, possibly 5%, although now it looks even less than that. Even their polling,
right.
And I take that with a grain of salt.
I don't
trust any methodology that comes from. Even their polling actually shows that Putin has more support than in the government polling. The government polling says about 70%. They say about 73%.
Right.
And it puts their own support lower than the government polling puts theirs, down below 2%, like, you know, less even than 2%, you know, down to the close to 1%. So if you don't believe the government polling, right, if you don't believe international pre-election polling, that's fine. Even the liberal pro-Western opposition's polling gives Putin better numbers than the government's own polling does. So
right.
His re-election is pretty much guaranteed. So okay. He will have every chance to put this plan into action. He focuses on the big economic goal moving forward. He has several different goals: demographic, you know, Russia's population, contrary to what President Obama seemed to believe just a few years ago, has been growing during every year of Obama's presidency, in fact, and continues you know, it's slight growth, it has to be said. But, you know, when we're comparing to, you know, other European
in
countries,
Germany,
the graying phenomena across first world countries around the world is actually quite impressive. Right. And it's no small part in due to government programs that have provided money and encouraged families to have two or even three children. And myself, I see it in Moscow all the time. I'm always amazed at the number of children running around.
You know, one of the things is that people can afford to do it. I mean, you know, when you're living under conditions of austerity that look like they're only going to get worse, it does not make you say to, you know, to your spouse, hey, let's have some more kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the, you know, the primary reasons, of course, for the big demographic dip during the 1990s when despair and economic collapse hit the country and everything.
Right.
But alone, economic recovery is not enough. Right. It helps. But it increased programs to for immigration, for myself being one of those, along with programs to provide money and benefits, you know, again, increasingly to families with more than one child have been a big benefit to that. But let's talk about the economy, because I think the bigger focus of the speech is there. And this is a nearly 2-hour speech. And I would say about 70% of it is directed at domestic audience, laying out the where we are now and where we want to go in the future. And a big part of that is economics. And he promises, or he sets the target of increasing GDP per capita. GDP adjusted per purchasing power parity, right? There's a big distinction between these two terms. GDP is often presented as some kind of measure to make Russia look like, you know, Nigeria with snow, or, you know, or something like that. GDP is a number that is often trotted out, and by itself it has very little meaning whatsoever. When you take a look at GDP per purchasing power parity, which is an actual measure for determining a company, again, in isolation, in itself, you know, you need some other context as well, but is a much better number to look at, and that puts Russia as the fifth or sixth largest economy, you know, depending on the last year, right neck and neck with Germany, and you know, projected to overpass them. So that gives us a much more realistic grounding, right? Russia is not, you know, the first, second economy in the world. That's China and the United States, right? But they are definitely in the top five, and anyone who tries to you know, project them as Nigeria with snow, or their economy is smaller than Italy's, or something like that, is just ridiculous. It's an isolated statistic, completely out of any context and connection with reality. So he wants to increase GDP adjusted per purchasing power parity per capita by 50%, which right away my first reaction was, That seems like a pretty big goal, and you better have some pretty strong goals, some pretty strong plans to develop it that much. And a big part of what he laid out for why he believes this is an ambitious but possible goal is how much in the last few years, what they have worked on is building all the preparations towards a rapid economic growth in the early 2020s. And he lays this out in a very detailed way, like you would expect an economist to do, right? So this might be over the heads of a lot of people, but he talked about how they've decoupled from the West and basically made the country sanction proof. He talks about how they've decoupled the economy from energy prices, where energy prices will always be, and high energy prices will always be of benefit to the economy and allow certain goals to be achieved, that they are not required for the budget, and that the resource dependency that, again, is also often falsely presented by Russia, they've decreased it even further just in the last 4 years. 4 years ago, despite what anyone says, it was about 15 to 17% of the GDP. Mm. That's oil and gas, and actually some other natural resources combined, which is nothing like Saudi Arabia or right. Norway or other countries like right, that, right, that, right. that are also big energy producers. But it's now at 7% of GDP.
Right.
So by far the biggest sector of Russia's economy is services, as mm. is the same for any of the big, you know, first world economies.
You know, and then on that same question, by the way, of becoming sanction proof, a substantial portion of the international trade in energy comes with that contract that they signed for natural gas with China. In other words, guaranteeing yeah. a nice piece of cash flow on that thing that is looked at as, okay, this is where, from time to time, as energy prices go up, we get this windfall. Yeah. That's like built in as a steady cash stream coming from the yes. world's largest economy, or in any event, the largest consumer of those things.
Yeah, yes. And China has had some, is looking to get more gas from Russia, actually, just right. as Europe is, right, with Nord Stream 2 and so on. China right. wants more gas because several other possible avenues are fraught with risk. Gas from Iran, you know, there's the naval route there, and things with Central Asia on a one-to-one basis between China and Central Asian companies haven't worked out quite as well as they wanted. Mm. So China's demanding more and more Russian gas. And then now China's looking at not only oil and gas, but they're starting to look at piping Russian water.
Right.
Which you know is another climate change effect. So yeah. that's part of the decoupling. A big part of it though was about banks and in the inflation mm-hmm. rate, and how the government in the last few years has brought the inflation rate down to just over 2%. It's mm-hmm. It's at a post-Soviet low. The economy is credibly stable. How they have managed to consolidate the banking sector, they've weeded out and allowed something that the U.S. would never do, and allowed weak banks. There's no such thing as too big to fail. Weak banks were allowed to die.
Mm. There you go.
While they, interestingly enough, while they made at least some measures to protect, small consumers,
mm-hmm. right.
but they've consolidated the banking sector. They've reduced the number of banks to some very solid banks with no overhanging debt. Russia's federal debt, by the way, is absolutely negligible.
Right. Right.
But they've worked on reducing Russia's corporate debt as well over the last few years, so that Russia's corporations, including state corporations, aren't vulnerable as they were at the start of the sanctions that the right. U.S. tried to cut Russia off from the international financial sectors and right. so on. So they've dealt with that. So one of the big things they're looking at is now they're going to start decreasing the price for loans, in particular mortgages, corporate loans, and so on, from state banks and from guaranteed Asian and Middle East sectors that don't have to rely on Western finance. And they're really going to be pushing low-cost mortgages, which is one of the vehicles that he outlines for increasing economic activity from within the country.
Right.
Another thing they've looked at is how Russia, the government has really focused on decreasing or increasing its strength in the international polling of ease of doing business. And anyone who's lived here for any length of time can tell you, I think the anecdotes, or at least give you some hint about how huge and unwieldy and annoying Russian bureaucracy could be. Well, they've vastly worked on that. I can see it here, even in local government services. But they've dropped Russia's ease of doing business in the last 8 years from 130th on the rank, 125th on the ranking, to like 30th.
Wow.
It's a huge job. They've done a lot to streamline, to encourage investment, right? Not only for Russian businesses, in particular small businesses, but of course in attempts to spur foreign investment, right? Mm-hmm. That's been a big problem with the sanctions from the U.S. and so on, at least from the West. But again, China and other Asian and Middle Eastern countries have been, right. stepping in there and basically cutting the sanctions have done nothing so much as cutting Europe out of Russian market share. So
Right.
You know, we have no tears in that regard. Mm. So all of this is towards the GDP. But he doesn't stop there. He also talks about the absolute need for Russia to move forward with the fourth industrial revolution. And he starts talking out, you know, very sophisticated terms, laying out what Russia needs to increase the ease of development in AI, drones, blockchain for financial transactions. He was getting very detailed, very technological, and he talks about how, you know, these are crucial years and Russia cannot afford to fall behind,
right,
in technology. In fact, he says that Russia's greatest threat, the greatest threat to Russia, the Russia's greatest enemy, is the threat of falling behind, and that will be his, you know, one of the primary focuses to make sure he doesn't. And the big thing is something I'm very glad to hear is increased education spending,
yeah,
something that has been negligent during most of Putin's previous administrations, something that one of my biggest criticisms of him so far. He seems to think now the economic conditions are stable enough and he wants to pile lots of money into science, technology, maths, and also provide money for young people to take basically internships with Russian companies, again, particularly in the technological,
right,
And finance sectors. Now, myself from the soft humanitarian social sciences side of it, I have to say that he doesn't seem to be putting much emphasis on culture or humanities and everything, you know, things that are close to my heart.
Right.
But he's a very pragmatic person, and you know, he's focused on this education thing. So, you know, as much as I can regret that in terms of doing what he can to improve Russian lives, state power, and ensuring the country moves forward, when you have to prioritize, you know, he's probably right for that, however much I may personally regret that. But he's focused on science, technology, and math.
We're talking about Russia here, okay? If you have a stable economy and people doing well in a stable economy, there's going to be culture up the yin-yang. That's just that's in the heart of that country. We're not talking about the United States, where a jack-in-the-box is going to spring up if you have some extra coin, okay? This is, you know, ballet, symphony, poetry, literature. This is Russia.
Well, I mean, there's a celebration of what has been, but, you know, innovation,
right,
in creativity and the social sciences and the humanities, you know, that some extra money always helps there
for
as
sure.
well. And then I'll be the first to say that Russian teachers in whatever fields are not paid enough. I hope that is part of the big part of this new program moving forward. So technology, education. He also talks infrastructure, something that Trump, you know, was elected in the United States on trying to talk a game and hasn't really been able to do much of anything on
yet.
Putin has really delivered on infrastructure building in Russia during the last eight years of his presidency, of presidency. Well, 4 years or 5 years, and then the terms before that, before Medvedev, before the, you know, the interim there. I mean, the number of when you're opening 70 new metro stations in the last few years in Moscow, something that seemed absolutely, you know, impossible to me on what is already one of the largest metro systems in the world, and in my
right.
opinion, simply the best in terms of ease and cost and the beauty of it and everything. They've done it, and they're continuing to build more. He wants to focus not just on Moscow and not just on the first tier cities, but he also wants to move beyond to the second and third tier cities, and in particularly the national roads, which Russia is the biggest country in the world by
right.
far, with
yeah.
a very unforgiving climate.
Yeah.
That makes the damage to roads, continual. And connecting the country via roads is something that, you know, that happened with the Soviet Union, but was never quite as developed as it was. Russia's always relied more on trains, and Russia's train systems are quite good, and they have been improved, and they're well along the way to implementing high-speed trains across most of the country at this point. But he wants to concentrate on the roads, and he's looking at allocating double the road budget, which has also increased in recent years as well. And I have to say it's needed. But, you know, again, considering the size of the country, the climate, you know, as someone who comes from Pennsylvania, someone with the worst roads in the United States for so many years that I think they even stopped looking at it, even considering it, just so you can give someone else a chance to have the worst roads. And seeing the similar, you know, the hilly, cold, high truck traffic, you know, and everything, what damage it does to roads, and then that type of variety. Russia's much worse, right? Much bigger. So I understand that. And of course, a big part of that is bringing down the corruption in the road building industries. So something that I think they've done corruption under Putin has definitely, you know, no one's going to say there isn't corruption in Russia or in any other country, but Putin has reduced corruption, and we can hope that he will look at it further. Of course, which he promises to do, but you know, we'll see about that.
Let me give people some context. It's 8 time zones, Russia, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a third of the linear surface of the planet. Okay, and the population of Russia is about shy of 150 million, and which is about half of the population of the United States. It's not even twice the population of Germany, which is like 70 or 80 or something, right? So, you know, you have like not a lot of people spread onto this massive. I mean, if you're going to connect one end to the other of the roads, that's a third of the way across the planet.
Yeah, well, that's part of the plans. So, yeah. He lays this all out in great detail. The English, first of all, RT had it live translation. You can watch the whole thing. It's a 2-hour speech if you want on RT.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Or the full Kremlin English official English transcript is out. It's on the president's page. It's easy to find. Or you know, hit me up and I'll easily send you a link to it if you can't find it yourself. I think it's one of these important national speeches. But if we jump past this domestic content, which is all very interesting for Russians and everything, and you know, in particularly light of the election coming up and everything, but the last third of the speech, I would say, is foreign policy and defense policy and in particular military policy, and it's directly at the United States.
Right.
And let's not mince words or anything there. And this speech, I think, the second part of this speech, I think, is as monumental as the 2007 Munich speech that Putin gave was. Warning. If you go back and look at that speech, and I think it's still crucial for understanding the world today, the geopolitical. This is this speech. This speech basically says, we warned you about it, and he's in fact Putin exactly says this. We tried to talk to you. Didn't want to listen to us.
Right.
Well, now you will hear us, and he said that explicitly in this speech, and. This second section here, Vasily Kashin at the Moscow's Higher School of Economics, and actually a very liberal school, neoliberal even, not my favorite school, not my type of favorite political representation there. But even he said of this speech, the speech can be represented by one huge middle finger. This part of it aimed at the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They declared a new Cold War on us. We accept. And that's what the second part of the speech is about.
Yep.
It is about a response to two things. It is about a response to the U.S. pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2001, something that Russia has talked again and again and again. There will be consequences. There will be consequences. There will be consequences. Yeah. Putin, in this speech, said, "Here are the we're done. Here are the consequences. This is how we have responded." And he laid out at least six, depending on how you count them, possibly seven new weapon systems, most of them nuclear. And these are all the majority of what we're talking about are designed to get around U.S. Missile defense. And it has to be said that, you know, when we're talking in terms of total strategic balance right now, you know, the U.S. doesn't have anything, right, that could prevent a U.S., a Russian response that would be equally devastating, right? But we're talking about the near future. We're talking about single missile fires, you know, that could, you know, possibly blow up, could be contained. We're talking about looking at a near future first strike capability and what Russia has done to prevent the U.S. from ever gaining that. Because that has something that military experts in the U.S., the more aggressive ones, have openly been talking about. That, you know, they're very salivating at the idea that we might soon have, you know, that they might soon have a first strike capability. They talk endlessly about it, and that, of course, is MAD, because that destroys MAD.
Right.
The mutually assured destruction, you know, something that, you know, many people might think is a relic of the Cold War, the first Cold War, and that ended, but, you know, that was only put on hiatus in the 1990s, and it's at us again. Russia insisted in 2001 when Bush pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty that, you know, you are trying to break the strategic balance, and we will have to correct that. And we don't want a new arms race. Well, you know, the new Cold War is here, if you want to call it that. I look at it more as great power struggle, but it's certainly here. And a lot of people after this speech are saying, oh, that Putin announced it. Well, no. The new arms race didn't just start, and Putin did not just announce it. He's just picking up the gauntlet, all right? I'm going to look just 2 weeks ago in the pages of the Washington Post, you know, the establishment magazine, an article by Katrina Vandenhoevel, who is the editor at The Nation.
Right.
The Nuclear Posture Review signals a new arms race. Right. That's not Russia. That's the United States.
That's right.
And this is a big part of the speech. It's a reply to two things. This military portion is a response, one, to the, you know, laying out what we've done for you pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile. The other part of it, and it's very angry, it's very Russia is clearly signaling they're not happy about it, and they're basically answering back. The new U.S. Nuclear Posture Review, put out by the Trump administration. You know, there were some leaks of it before, but it's officially been put out in the last month, and it's been almost completely ignored in the Western press. Right? No one wants to hear it. Just even the name of it sounds boring, I guess. The Nuclear Posture Review. But this is extremely aggressive. It talks about decreasing the size of nuclear weapons, something that, you know, we know has already been done, but also about deploying them.
That's right.
Putting them on the front lines in Europe. Yep. In fact, training up European countries to use them as well.
Yep.
And indicating that they would use these mini nukes against conventional forces.
That's right.
Right? Not they're talking about a first strike.
They're talking about them being used.
Conventional forces.
Yeah, they're talking about them actually being used in the strategies that they're using for, like, actual engagements.
First.
So we're out of time. I just want to say this part, because Putin responded to that and said, listen, you know, whatever you guys want to put down in your little books and whatever you have planned to do or whatever, if you attack us, we're going to throw everything we got at you. And we got all this stuff now. So you better listen.
Hypersonic weapons, underwater drones.
That's right.
Nuclear powered cruise missiles. We have it all now.
That's
and it's much cheaper to build missiles that can evade missile defense than it is to build missile defense. If you want to make this an arms race, we'll beat you on cost. Now.
That's right. That's right. And hey, look at the economy. Okay, Mark, thank you very much. We appreciate it, and we'll speak with you again soon.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.